This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben. Today, I'm delighted to say my guest is Philip Freeman. Philip teaches at Pepperdine University. He writes extensively on the Roman world and late antiquity. I know him best for his work in early medieval Ireland. I'm excited to talk to Philip today. I've enjoyed his work for many years. And the book that we're going to discuss today is a book that he has edited and translated, Two Lives of St. Bridget, recently published by Four Courts Press. Philip, many congratulations on the book and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Now, I mentioned the introduction. I've been reading your work for quite a number of years. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to the position you're in just now?
Yes, I started off as an undergraduate studying classics, so studying Greek and Latin. And then only when I was really beginning my master's degree in classics was I exposed to the early Irish material. And it was fascinating because of its content, but also because there really had not been a lot of work done on it. So after I finished my master's in classics, I thought I would really like to go and study Celtic languages and literature. And so I went to Harvard and I got a PhD eventually in both classics and Celtic studies. So I combined the two. And that has just been great, a great background for me. Wonderful professors there, many of them from Ireland, who taught me the Old Irish history. And then I went on, and it's been, 30 years now that I have been a professor. Very fortunate in America, where the job market is not that good, I've been able to find gainful employment continuously. And now I am I think the last job of my life. I'm at Pepperdine University in beautiful Malibu, California, which is a great distraction because my office overlooks the Pacific Ocean. So it's very easy to daydream rather than thinking about Old Irish as much as I should.
And Philip, do you surf?
I do not. I do not at all. I'm not even a very good swimmer. But you certainly see every morning the people line up on the beaches of Malibu. And so if any of your Irish listeners are surfers, come to Malibu. It's a great place.
Fantastic. Now, Philip, that's a really interesting summary of your career to date. Tell us a little bit about the background to this book in particular. You have been writing, editing, translating material in this field for quite a while, but what took you to Bridget in particular?
Well, I first read the life of the lives of St. Bridget back when I was in graduate school, and was struck about just how fascinating the stories are, but also by the fact that there really was not an edition available on the lives of St. Bridget. There have been the last actual edition, critical edition of the Latin text was back in the 1600s. But there have been a couple of excellent translations since then, but they're a bit scattered and sort of hard to pull together. And so I thought it would be really great to look at the original Latin manuscripts and do my own edition and do a translation and put it all into one volume so that it would be available for students, for scholars, for general readers, for anybody, so that they could read these stories for themselves, because I think these stories, they're just fascinating to read, but they're also really useful for people in a wide variety of fields, history of Christianity, Irish history, gender studies, you name it. There's a lot of rich material here for people to draw on.
Now, Philip, the title of the book is Two Lives of Saint Bridget, but might there be two Bridgets?
There could be. I mean, there's certainly, we have Bridget the saint, and then we have Bridget, as we know from Irish other Irish sources, who was a goddess. And of course, many people have tried to say the two are basically the same. And what I try to do, hopefully very gently and in a very understanding way, is to focus on Bridget the saint and say, yes, of course, Bridget was a goddess. And I think they're absolutely influences from the pre-Christian traditions in the stories of the saint, but I really wanted to put the focus more back on the saint herself.
Now, in the introduction, you tell us that one of the texts you edit and translate here exists in about 30 versions. The other text exists in just above 80 versions. Yes. How many lives of Bridget are there? And
there are. Well, there are two, I'm sorry, there are two lives in Latin and one in Old Irish. Actually, there's more than that, but the others come from a later period. So there are three early lives. The Old Irish life was translated and edited wonderfully several decades ago. It's called Bethu Brichte by Danica O'Hea, was the one who translated it and edited it. And so it's available. That was already done. That's there for people. And there was no way I could do a better job than he did. So I left that life out, and I just did the two Latin lives of Bridget, and I pulled together the I didn't do all 80 manuscripts of one of them, of Cogitosis, but I did say the top dozen or so, the oldest and what I thought of was the best. And so I took the two different the life of Cogitosis, and then the Vita Prima is what it's called, the first life of Saint Bridget, and that's actually longer. And it's called the Vita Prima because back in the 1600s, it was put first in the catalog. And so it's not, I don't think it's earlier in the sense, it's not primary in that sense, but it's just a simple ordering. And the life of Cogitosis was actually called the Vita Secunda, the second life. And so I switched those around a little bit because I think the general consensus, as much as scholars can agree on anything, is that the Cogitosis probably was written first, and the Vita One came later, and then the Old Irish Life also came later.
I mean, I think it's fair to say, Philip, your Irish readers won't need an explanation as to why the Vita Prima comes second. It makes absolute sense to us. So we have these two texts. They have a relationship, a kind of a genealogical relationship to each other. What's the relationship between the two Latin texts and the texts in early Irish that the other colleague edited? I think in the 1970s, wasn't it?
1970s, yes. I think there probably was an earlier, at least one earlier life of Bridget, which did not survive, and that was a source for probably all three, and other materials out there too that just didn't make it. But I think, at least, the Cogitosis version of the life of Bridget is the earliest. It comes along in the mid-7th century. And I think that the Vita Prima certainly knew, the writer of the Vita Prima certainly knew about Cogitosis's work and draws on it. In fact, if you look at the very end of the Vita Prima, it seems to be almost a condensed version of Cogitosis. It takes the miracles and puts them in short, quick order at the end. And so I think the Vita Prima drew on Cogitosis, but also probably on other sources as well. And then the Bethu Brichte, the Old Irish version, I think certainly knew about Cogitosis and probably knew about the Vita Prima, but they are the Old Irish also is independent of that. So if I tried to draw a tree, you know, where they all came from and how they relate, I would just end up confusing myself more than anybody. But I think Cogitosis is first, and that it influenced the later lives that came along as well.
Yes, it's interesting you say that. The brevity of incidents at the end of the Vita Prima is really striking. I remember the passage where the holy saint puts her fingers into a stone, and then the narrator says, "But I don't have time to tell you why."
Yeah, of course he had plenty of time. He could, you know, he wasn't running out of paper or parchment or anything.
So why do you think the stories are abbreviated at the end of the Vita Prima?
I really get the feeling, and this is not terribly academic to say a thing to say, but that the writer of the Vita Prima was, you know, he had so much fun, or she, I guess it could be a woman, but we don't know who the author was, but they enjoyed telling this story. And then, you know, somebody said, you really ought to include those miracles that Cogitosis put into. And so he says, okay. And so just boom, 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 and puts those in a slightly different version, a slightly abbreviated version. But, honestly, I don't know why. That's just a guess.
So we have two texts here, one by Cogitosis. We don't know too much about him.
He was a churchman, a priest in Armagh, down just west of Dublin, but we don't know a whole lot about him. No.
And the Vita Prima, do we know much about authorship of that text?
We don't know who wrote it. No, we really don't. The Latin of both texts is good. I mean, I think the Cogitosis is a little bit better, but the Vita Prima is actually very good Latin. So we can tell that both authors were well-schooled. They knew the traditions. They knew about Christian tradition of hagiography, about, you know, the life of St. Anthony or St. Martin or whatever. They, you know, they're well-versed in Christian biographies. So they were both written by educated people, that we certainly know. They get all the Irish names right. So they probably were Irish too. In fact, we know Cogitosis was Irish, and I would bet you anything the Vita Prima author was as well.
Now, I think what's really striking about your edition is you show how deeply the Irish context, probably of composition, affects these texts. But you also show us over what a broad geographical area these texts have been collected and preserved. Can you comment on that a little bit for us?
Yeah, the Cogitosis manuscripts, of which there are, say, 80 or so, and the Vita Prima, for that matter, they are almost all found not in Ireland. They are almost all found in France or Austria, Italy, Germany. There are some that are found in England, but those probably came from France. So what it tells us is, I think, that when the Irish monks went out in their great diaspora at the beginning of the Christian era, and they went to Europe, they took these manuscripts with them. They took these stories of Brigid with them. We get the same thing with St. Patrick, really. Aside from the Book of Armagh in Trinity College, all the manuscripts are somewhere else on the continent. I think it tells us that these stories were very popular. They were copied. The fact that we have so many manuscript versions of them really is telling that they were widely accepted. They were widely sought after. And so I think that this, it really tells us something about the popularity, at least of St. Brigid, on the continent of Europe.
So these are didactic books in a way, as well as being memorial books, aren't they? But what kinds of purpose do they serve? Do they give us any kind of historical evidences that we can use?
It's interesting. I think they do. They actually do give us historical evidence. But as I tell my students, the main point of hagiography, the main point of these writing sacred lives, is not history at all. It's to tell Christians how to live a better life, to say, this is an example for you to follow. And so they are didactic. That is absolutely their main function. And so we get miracles, we get Brigid doing all sorts of things, all sorts of miracles, most of which are based very clearly on the Bible, the miracles of Jesus. But there are historical elements in it. And I think it's wonderful if you look, there's a great story in Cogitosis about a millstone Brigid actually, after she dies, some people pray to her for her help in moving this gigantic heavy millstone. And so they go into some details about about waterworks and mills in Ireland. So there's some wonderful passages that you can draw out. They talk about the church at Armagh, the architecture of the church at Armagh, which is a rich and fantastic source on early church decorations and architecture. And then there are all sorts of little bits and pieces throughout the stories, which I think are definitely very historical. They mention different monks and druids and whatever who I think they they're talking about the world of the 7th century. Just if I were to write a science fiction story set in the 24th century, it would really be about right now. So it tells you about what's going on during the 7th century when these stories are being written.
Now, you mentioned there, Philip, that perhaps most of the miracle stories have biblical roots. Jesus Christ turns water into wine, Bridget turns water into beer, etc. Then we also have miracle stories that don't have any obvious biblical root. The appearance of a demon that's linked to sloth, the speedy movement, almost instantaneous movement of a man with cattle across vast geographical distances and so on. You hinted earlier on as well that the earlier Celtic or pre-Christian goddess Bridget has a legacy. Do we find her legacy in any of these miracle stories?
I think we probably do. There are some people who would argue that no, there is nothing there, but I think so. The Bridget that we have, she performs an awful lot of animal miracles. Reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in the New Testament, Jesus doesn't have a whole lot to do with animals. And neither do the early saints. So I think that there's something going on here drawing on the stories of the goddess Brigid, of which honestly we know very little, who is, there's some animal stuff going on there and some other things that are just odd. They strike a reader of hagiography as just odd. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that all of those automatically have a pagan source, have a pre-Christian source. But I think that's something that people should definitely look at. And I would be very interested in people looking more deeply into these stories and seeing if they can find antecedents in other stories, Irish pre-Christian stories. But there is a lot of material there which just seems unusual for a Christian hagiography.
Is that distinction between miracle stories with biblical roots and non-biblical roots, is that something that we project back anachronistically onto these texts? In other words, would their earliest readers have been able to make that distinction?
I think, I think they would have known, like when Bridget turns water into beer. In fact, Cogitosis says, this is just like Jesus did at Cana in Galilee. I think they would have picked up very quickly on that. But I do wonder in some of the stories where she does things, where she makes, for example, there's a story where she, a young nun becomes pregnant and she makes a fetus disappear. And this is certainly, not according to traditional Christian teachings at all. And so I think there's certainly some things going on there, which go back to a pre-Christian time, I would think.
Do those kinds of stories help us understand the conceptual world of early Irish Christianity?
I think so. For example, if you look at the story of Bridget and this young pregnant nun, and you think about this nun, she's given up her family. She has joined a convent and she's become pregnant. And Cogitosis says through youthful lust through normal human lust. And then now she is, by church law, should be kicked out of the convent. And, where is she going to go? She can't go home. She can't stay there. She's probably going to starve to death. And so what Bridget does is look on her with great mercy and great understanding and makes the fetus disappear, sort of resets everything. And then the young woman still has to go on and do penance after that. So I think it tells you some, that's just one small example of what's going on in the early Irish church. It does, I think, does give us a really nice snapshot, multiple snapshots of what's going on.
One of the things that struck me reading the Vita Prima was the reference to Rome and Bridget sending emissaries to Rome to pick up in current practice, and then revisiting that particular aspiration several years, I think it was, later. Do we find in these texts any evidence of the institutional evolution of the Irish Church?
Well, I think so, and that's a good example about the growing ties to Rome. I think that's in the Vita Prima, and I like that where she revises the order of the Mass at Kildare, and then she hears that it's been revised again, and so she sends to Rome and she's getting updates from Rome to keep things in line with the Roman practice. And so I think there are actually hints not just hints but references. In the lives about the development of the Irish Church, and for example, in Cogitosis, we never have St. Patrick mentioned. It's everything takes place right there in Kildare, and in the Vita Prima, which is probably a little bit later, we have Patrick shows up all the time, and Bridget, who is no wilting flower, is absolutely very subservient to him. And so I think that's an indication of the subordination of the church in the south, ultimately to the north, to Armagh. And so I think that there's some wonderful evidence that can be drawn like that.
Is it possible to read the Vita Prima as represent in its description of movements across the entirety of the island, as representing a more national conception of Christianity than the Cogitotis?
I think so, and that is something very significant about the Vita Prima, is that Bridget is always moving. She's moving all over the place, going up to the north, going down to the south, and so there is much more of a nationalistic feeling in the Vita Prima, that the Irish Church is, it encompasses the entire island, where in Cogitosis, she's it makes claim that, this is the greatest church in all of Ireland, but she hardly ever leaves Kildare. And so I think, I think there's absolutely some information that can be drawn there.
Well, Philip, as you've edited and translated these works and brought them now through to published version just before St. Bridget's Day on the 1st of February earlier this year, when I picked up my copy, what most excites you about this project?
Oh, this was just a joy to work on, because it had never been done before, at least not all in one like this. And I teach this material to my undergraduate students here at in America, and Bridget stories are very popular. They love these stories. They're great, and we talk about them and what they mean. And so it's a great chance to help my students and to help hopefully other students read about this. And just the whole idea that discovering the role of women in the early Irish Church, that I was able to make some small contribution to this, I'm very pleased with.
Great. Have any of your students ever tried to turn water into beer?
They might. I don't know, but I'm sure they've certainly tasted beer. Even though Pepperdine is supposedly a dry campus, I really don't think it is.
I think we'll edit that bit out of the interview, Philip. Well, listen, it's been great to talk to you today, and you've been very generous in giving us some of your time. But before we wind up the interview, could you tell us what you're working on next?
Yes, I'm working on a translation of Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy. So it's an early 6th century text, and it's a wonderful story written in prison and it's really, you could look at it as either the last great work of Roman times or the first great work of medieval times, but I'm translating that for Princeton University Press.
Brilliant. That's certainly a work with a very important afterlife as well, isn't it?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Great. Philip Freeman, it's been great to speak to you today about your new book, Two Lives of St. Bridget, just published by Four Courts Press. Thanks to you for coming along today, and thanks to everyone else for listening in. I'll see you next time on the New Books Network podcast.